Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Big on ideas, short on specifics.
In the 21st century, best anti-poverty program around is a world-class education. And in this country, the success of our children cannot depend more on where they live than on their potential.
No. It was a realistic outline of how to accomplish some tangible goals.
To make college more affordable, this bill will finally end the unwarranted taxpayer subsidies that go to banks for student loans. Instead, let's take that money and give families a $10,000 tax credit for 4 years of college and increase Pell Grants.
The problem with political rhetoric is that two people hear the same words and understand them to mean very different things. So what did you hear? We're listening on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 28th, and the takeaway for me is, as difficult as I imagine it is to write a State of the Union speech, to a certain extent it almost doesn't matter, because people are going to have, in Washington at least, predictable reactions.
Well, it's like the telephone book. You have to cover everything. Yeah. Although he didn't mention steroids in baseball at all. That was in a State of the Union address under the Bush administration. So let's get right to the top stories, and that speech is the top story this morning, President Obama's tough tone.
Despite our hardships, our union is strong. We do not give up. We do not quit. We do not allow fear or division to break our spirit.
In his first State of the Union address, the president vowed to make job growth a top priority.
People are out of work. They're hurting. They need our help. And I want a jobs bill on my desk without delay.
He also called for a new tax credit for small businesses that hire workers. And on the issue of health care, he had this message.
Here's what I ask Congress, though. Don't walk away from reform. Not now. Not when we are so close.
The president took some blame. He said he may not have done a good job explaining the health care bill to Americans.
And for reaction to the president's address, we're joined now by Ted Widmer. He's the former speechwriter for Bill Clinton and the director now of the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University. Good morning, Ted.
Morning.
You heard us going over some of the points in the president's speech, but I'm wondering, what was the one thing that stood out the most for you?
Well, he's fighting back, but he's got his work cut out for him.
That took a lot less time than President Obama took to give his State of the Union speech. Brief, a good summation. We're going to get more details from you, Ted, in just a moment. We'll be back to talk about in detail about the speech.
You might say Toyota wishes it was Ford Motor Company this morning. Toyota is recalling 1 million vehicles over problems with floor mats. The newest recall affects 5 models and comes a day after Toyota said it was suspending U.S. sales of 8 of its most popular models, even stopping the assembly lines due to faulty accelerator pedals. And in the past hour, Toyota says it's recalling more than 75,000 vehicles in China for the same gas pedal problem behind the U.S. recall.
Times are better, as you said, at Ford. The company reported a $2.7 billion profit in 2009. That's the first full-year profit in 4 years. Let's move on now to Haiti, where a U.S. embassy spokesman says there are still parts of the country that aren't getting regular supplies of food and water. Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, Haitian singer Wyclef Jean listed what the country needs right now.
Haiti needs water. Haiti needs food. Haiti needs medicine. And Haiti needs tents. And when we say need, meaning we need the logistics to get these things to the people, too.
The UN World Food Program says it needs $800 million in cash right away to feed 2 million survivors through the rest of the year. Taking a look at the market, futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,236, the S&P at 1,097, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,221. So coming up, in his address last night, President Obama said this.
There's no reason Europe or China should have the fastest trains.
But there are some good reasons why they do have the fastest trains. We're going to talk about how we can fix the rail system later this hour.
Did you have a favorite line from the speech?
What frustrates the American people is a Washington where every day is election day.
That's what Mark in Westport loved about the speech. He emailed us at thetakeaway.org. You know how to reach us at 877-8MYTAKE. Coming up, more about the speech.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
These were the times that tested the courage of our convictions and the strength of our union. And despite all our divisions and disagreements, our hesitations and our fears, America prevailed because we chose to move forward as one nation, as one people.
That's President Obama opening his State of the Union address last night. And here to give us some expert analysis of the speech is Ted Widmer, former speechwriter for Bill Clinton and currently the director of the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University. Also joining us, Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick to talk about the reaction on both sides of the aisle. Ted, usually we're used to presidents opening their speech by saying the state of our union is strong. Even in tough times, Ronald Reagan in 1982 said the state of the union will get better. A year later, he said the state of the union is strong, but the economy's troubled. And Gerald Ford famously said in 1975, the state of our union is not good. So what was your reaction to the way Barack Obama decided to open his speech without specifically mentioning the State of the Union?
Well, he did sneak it in there. He said,
despite
our hardships, our union is strong. But I don't think it would have gone over that well. I mean, people are uneasy, and I think he had to acknowledge that, and he did. But he didn't want to be too defeatist either, so he managed to get it in there, but in a clever way that wasn't quite the way we've heard it year after year from George W. Bush. It was just the State of the Union is strong over and over and over again.
Right. He snuck it in, but it was like three or four pages into it.
He almost said it while they were applauding. I mean, he had to listen to hear it.
Right. He covered a huge range of topics. Here's what he had to say about jobs.
Now, the House has passed a jobs bill that includes some of these steps. As the first order of business this year, I urge the Senate to do the same, and I know they will. They will. People are out of work. They're hurting. They need our help. And I want a jobs bill on my desk without delay.
So, Ted Widmer, he said that jobs should be the number one priority. Do you think the speech was, A, specific enough, or and B, do you really think the politicians are going to respond to his demand for a jobs bill?
Yes, I think, there was a lot of meat he threw out there in jobs, in education. He doesn't want to give up on health care. Provocative things like putting all earmarks on a website online, some anti-lobbyist language. I mean, there was a ton in that speech, but we'll see how it fares in Congress.
Was he more careful, do you think, this time? Or do you think he'd learned lessons from making deadlines and specific promises that he ended up, because of one reason or another, not being able to deliver on?
I think that's a good point. I think there is a feeling that a lot of the things he promised a year ago have not happened. So he was careful not to do anything like that last night, but then you get into an opposite area of trouble, which is if you don't have any specific promises, then it just sounds vague. And he was getting near a level of vagueness that was troubling, but still I think he pulled it off.
Okay, well, here's one place in which he was very specific.
Yesterday, the Senate blocked a bill that would have created this commission. So I'll issue an executive order that will allow us to go forward, because I refuse to pass this problem on to another generation of Americans. And when the vote comes tomorrow, the Senate should restore the pay-as-you-go law that was a big reason for why we had record surpluses in the 1990s.
He's talking about issuing an executive order to create a commission to deal with the deficit. Can he make that kind of promise and deliver it?
I think time will tell. I mean, he's said it, so he's going to do it, but we'll see what the commission can get accomplished.
Well, what do you think about the effectiveness of saying that in the speech? Is he talking to the American people or to the legislators in the audience?
I think he's talking to the American people more than to anyone. I think they needed a comeback speech. He's had a bumpy few weeks, and they needed to hear Obama, the candidate, and he can't quite be that anymore because it's a year later. We haven't seen as much change as he promised, but we needed a fighting spirit again. And I mean, he did a good, solid effort. It might not have been inspiring the way campaign speeches are supposed to be, but I did think it was a good, solid effort.
Okay, a good solid effort. That's what Ted Widmer, Ford's former speechwriter for Bill Clinton, says. Now let's hear from Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Todd, you heard Ted saying that the Republicans didn't seem to respond to anything, even cutting taxes. Did you see that as the case?
No, I didn't. Good morning, Celeste. I didn't. I was sitting in the room for the speech listening to the president and really for most of the time had my eyes locked on the Republican side to see their reactions. The president did toss them some meat and they rose to their feet a couple of times. The president's call to eliminate all capital gains as part of a job recovery program. They got on their feet for that. They got on their feet a couple of times for some of the pro-USA American exceptionalism parts of the speech as well.
And what were their issues? We heard them saying that he's proposed things that the United States can't afford.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the Republicans afterwards, Celeste, were sort of saying, and I think it was interesting because they knew this president would give a stirring speech, a good speech. He's an excellent orator. They knew that. So one of the Republican talking points that you heard after the speech as you walked around and talked to them is, well, it's not so much what the president says, it's what he's going to do. And they can't afford to come out of a speech like this and be on the Obama bandwagon. So they were sort of pre-programmed to expect a well-delivered speech, but to oppose the policies that are in it. But he tossed Republicans a bunch of things that they really can't oppose. Eliminating capital gains tax. The president came out for nuclear power plants, for building nuclear power plants. He came out for offshore drilling. This is all stuff that Republicans can't help but love. Can't really love it too much or else they start to get on his bandwagon. But he was trying to, I think, draw Republicans in and sort of take away some of the objections that they
have. Any response to the gays in the military, the ban on the removal of the ban on gays in the military? I mean, Clinton almost died on that whole policy.
Yeah, John, it was a really quick mention that sort of came and went in one line. Everyone was expecting because it had been telegraphed by the White House before. Not a huge amount of reaction there. It was sort of buried in the speech in a quick moment.
And the other side of the aisle that we haven't talked about yet is the Democrats, and we heard the president kind of talking tough to them, telling them that they are in control of Congress and they need to not run for the hills. It'd be interesting I'm assuming the Democrats weren't happy about that characterization of them, but we'd have to find out about that later. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, and Ted Widmer, former speechwriter to Bill Clinton and director of the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to hear more coverage to the reaction of the speech later. Stay with us. It's now 15 minutes past the hour. Let's take a look at the headlines.
First State of the Union speech from President Obama focusing on fixing the economy and creating jobs. We're going to have analysis throughout the show. Senate Democrats are expected to put their 60-vote majority to some use today on Capitol Hill. While they still can, they're set to raise the federal debt ceiling by $1.9 trillion. Abroad, a summit on the future of Afghanistan is underway in London. Countries are expected to set up a fund to help lure Taliban fighters back into Afghan society. President Hamid Karzai said it could take 10 to 15 or 5 to 10 years for Afghan forces to take over from the American-led coalition and perhaps even longer to end his country's dependence on foreign financial aid. Reaction to the idea of reintegrating Taliban into Afghan forces and Afghan society in a conversation with General David Petraeus about Afghanistan. That conversation coming up in about 15 minutes.
Moving now to Haiti, where a U.S. embassy spokesman says there are still parts of the country that aren't getting regular supplies of food and water.
You can find pockets, particularly near the epicenter and in outlying areas where we have yet to reach the population with any regularity.
To combat that problem, one relief spokesperson says groups are dividing up the capital. Each major aid agency is responsible for delivering food to their designated sector. Ford reporting a $2.7 billion profit for 2009. That's their first full-year profit in 4 years. We recently spoke with the Ford CEO, Alan Mulally, and you can hear that entire interview at thetakeaway.org, although he refused to broadcast his happiness over his upcoming profit earnings. So look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're going to be talking about comments that Chris Matthews had about the president.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Hey, you want that to go?
Well, President Obama is generally acknowledged as an inspiring speaker, but MSNBC's Chris Matthews was inspired in a controversial way after the State of the Union speech last night.
You know, I was trying to think about who he was tonight, and it's interesting. He is post-racial, by all appearances. You know, I forgot he was black tonight for an hour.
I forgot Chris Matthews is still on the air.
Oh, harsh.
Wow.
Matthew's lying
about... What is he talking about?
Well, it was part of a longer comment. Uh-huh. You have to kind of put that one in context. But that particular part of it, I forgot he was black for an hour, has very quickly bounced around Twitter and the blogosphere, received widespread criticism. We're joined now by David Wall Rice, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Morehouse College in Atlanta. David, what is your reaction to this comment?
You know, I feel bad almost for saying this, but I didn't think it was a particularly big deal. Like you said, I think that, you know, oftentimes context matters. And I think that in the context of what he was trying to say and trying to explain, I didn't really see it as being a big deal.
Okay, so since you're talking about context, let's hear a little bit more of what he said around that comment.
I think it was in the scope of his discussion. It was so broad-ranging, so in tune with so many problems and aspects of American life that you don't think in terms of the old tribalism, the old ethnicity. It was astounding in that regard, a very mm-hmm. subtle fact. It's so hard to even talk about. Maybe I shouldn't talk about it, but I am. I thought it was profound that way.
He sounds a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't talk about it, he said. What do you feel about his kind of anguish there over how he's reacting?
Well, I think it's probably indicative of how a lot of white Americans might feel or might be or how they might be negotiating this issue of race when they see this black power in front of them in halls of what has heretofore been white largely. So I think that, you know, it's something that probably is something he might have uncovered a bit in terms of how white America is dealing with this appearance of somebody who is talking sense in a space that heretofore, like I said, has been the province of white males.
Well, you know, the one thing that did strike me that does upset me a little is the use of the word, the phrase post-racial. That's something that I kind of have questions about.
Well, certainly, I think I was given pause there as well. Certainly, we're not post-racial. I've written and talked about that on The Takeaway before. But I think that what Chris Matthews was able to do was he was very much personalizing it. And he talked about, by all appearances, he is post-racial. Now, certainly, he did not suggest that we live in a post-racial society. Now, what he is talking about is he's talking about his steps and perhaps other white Americans' steps toward a post-racial space. We certainly aren't there yet. I mean, I think that if we look at the response from the governor of Virginia, I think if we look at the staging there, it wasn't forgotten that Barack Obama was black, by the way that we zoomed in on the black faces in there and we stressed this multiculturalism. I think that becomes important, but if you look at Justice Alito, and you know, this is just my perspective, if you look at Justice Alito and his response to Barack Obama's criticism of the Supreme Court decision just days ago, and his saying that's not true. I think if you look at how individuals respond to this power that has not been present before, there is discomfort. You know, there is this kind of willingness, I don't want to talk about it. There is this, that's not true, be quiet. You know, there is kind of this visceral response that we're going through. I think it's healthy, though.
Well, you know, I guess for me, post-racial coming from Chris Matthews sounds a little like jargon. I really kind of don't even know what he's talking about there. And as far as forgetting that he's black, I would have thought a lot of Americans would have done that quite a while ago. I mean, you had the inaugural. I mean, he won by such an extraordinary margin. I mean, this forgetting that he's African-American is not something that just occurs in the middle of this speech, it seems to me. And to describe it as so astute feels a little patronizing.
Yeah, I agree with you there, John. And I do think that one thing that's going on is he's working through it. You know, think that...
You're absolutely right.
I don't think this is the first time he said something like this. I think he's negotiating and working through it. And from a psychological perspective, I think that's healthy. And I think it's healthy that we have this kind of dialogue.
You know, David Wall Rice of Morehouse
Psychology
College
professor,
in Atlanta.
Right.
I want to read you this Twitter response from somebody named Vincenzo. He said, Chris Matthews forgot Barack Obama was black. Oh, wow. That'll only last until the next time someone criticizes him. Then he's black again.
You want my response to that?
Yeah.
I think he's right. I mean, that makes sense. I think that, again, I think that we're working through something here. And so let me say that last night when I was watching the State of the Union address, I didn't forget he was black. You know, I did not forget that.
That's
as a black male, I recognized who it was that was speaking and the uniqueness and transformative experience of it all. Now, the way that we engage that transformative experience is going to be different. And, you know, again, we're working through things. But certainly I think that, you know, when you make a mistake, you know, I think that, you know, different attention comes to you in ways that might be uncomfortable as well. And race becomes salient again because
right.
we live in a racialized society.
But, David, you know, regarding that Twitter right there and something you said a moment ago about Justice Alito, I mean, people are going to probably respond to what you were saying a moment ago and saying, well, is he saying that anytime you criticize Barack Obama, it's because you're uncomfortable about him being black or you're responding to this uncomfortableness of black power? Is that what you were saying?
I think that that is a valid perspective, especially from me being a black male. And so if I'm wrong, then that might be my way of working through issues. But I definitely think that when you look at the type of criticism or the level of criticism, being a black male and looking at a black male in that space, I'm able to say there become these kind of microaggressive moments, is what we call them in psychology, where did he do that because he was black or was there really valid criticism of his position? So the idea becomes that, you know, maybe I'm hypersensitive. Maybe Chris Matthews is hypersensitive, but I think it becomes important for us to put these feelings and perspectives out there so that we can go about the business of governing appropriately and taking the cover off of all these kind of unsaid things.
David Walrice is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Morehouse College in Atlanta. Many people said one of the best things about Barack Obama taking office is that it would spark nuanced conversations about race. I think that's one thing that's coming true.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, State of the Union Week continues. The voice of General David Petraeus, conversation about what's going on in Afghanistan and the state of the unions he's responsible for. He's the head of U.S. Central Command. That's in a few moments. Right now, top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. In his first State of the Union address last night, President Obama had a message for Republicans.
Just saying no to everything may be good short-term politics, but it's not leadership.
Earlier on The Takeaway, Congressman Eric Cantor, the Republican whip, had this reaction.
I'm all about coming together. The problem is the words are one thing. It is the actions that have been lacking.
The president called for actions, especially cooperation from Congress on both sides of the aisle on health care reform.
Moving now to Haiti, where a U.S. embassy spokesman says there are still parts of the country that aren't getting regular supplies of food and water. Earlier on The Takeaway, Haitian singer Wyclef Jean told us aid delivery is slow.
I just was back there 2 days ago, and we still have a backup of supplies at the airport, you know? They have to be a quicker way for the aid to get to the people.
Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
In London today, at a conference on Afghanistan, Afghan President Hamid Karzai is expected to address ways of reintegrating some Taliban back into the Afghan political process and into society as a whole. It's a provocative way forward in Afghanistan, and it has the support of some U.S. officials, among them the head of U.S. Central Command, General David Petraeus, who commands forces in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. I spoke with him yesterday in Washington, D.C., and asked him if we're seeing a shift in U.S. policy in Afghanistan, away from nation-building and more toward simply containment.
I'm not sure I'd completely subscribe to that, but I would. I think what is important in that particular concept is the recognition that this is not the kind of war that we've had occasionally in the past where you take the hill, plant the flag, and go home to a victory parade. This is a struggle against extremism, and a struggle against not just extremism, but transnational extremists who want to, again, attack us and our partners. And that's not a struggle that's going to be won in a year or 2 years. This is something we're going to be engaged in for some time, really for the foreseeable future. Having said that, that doesn't mean that it is always our soldiers that have to do the fighting. In Yemen, coming to that, for example, it is the Yemeni forces on the ground who have been conducting the operations against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, as it was labeled last year by al-Qaeda's senior leadership, in a sense franchising the al-Qaeda elements that were there, some of which we'd been watching, frankly, for two and a half years. When I was in Iraq, we were concerned about developments in Yemen after the prison break of 2006, in which the current now leader of al-Qaeda in Yemen escaped along with about 20 to 25 of his confederates, all hardcore al-Qaeda. That was the nucleus of what we are now seeing so threatening. And, of course, you know, that was the origin of the would-be Detroit attacker, among a number of other different threat streams that are out there.
Well, along that thread, are you confirming then the stories in the Washington Post this morning that there are a number of advisors and trainers on the ground in Yemen who aren't actually conducting operations but are training and possibly directing operations against al-Qaeda in Yemen?
Yeah, I don't really want to get into all the details, and I certainly don't want to confirm or deny all the aspects of that particular story. But we have security assistance efforts throughout the world. We certainly have them in just about every country in the Central Command region, not everyone, not in Iran or Syria.
Well, and among its greatest sensitivities there in Yemen is the presence of U.S. forces on the ground in a overt
Indeed.
Or secret capacity.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if it makes your job more difficult to have senior administration officials really crowing about the operation on background in the Washington Post.
Well, look, I think President Saleh has been very clear, actually, about what is going on. So I don't think this – they're not, you know, enormous revelations. I think what's happened is things have been pulled together by some reporters. But the fact is, you know, I went to see him also on the 2nd of January. This – we would have kept this secret if it had been desired. I actually had a little bit of subterfuge. We put plane up in the Sinai, got on a different one, flew down, and so forth, just for a period of hours to meet with him and various individuals in the embassy and the ambassador. And actually within an hour of that meeting, video of that meeting was on Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera provided by his office. So he's not overly sensitive
about this. Right.
But he has also, and his foreign minister, has very clearly drawn lines about the level of the assistance. And they have said that U.S. forces are not going to be conducting ground combat operations together with them.
That's General David Petraeus. I traveled to Washington, D.C. yesterday to speak to him directly about plans to buy off the Taliban in Afghanistan, something General Stanley McChrystal on the ground there has explicitly endorsed. Petraeus himself has been quoted as saying that money is a kind of ammunition to fight insurgency. So, if a large component of U.S. strategy puts members of the Taliban on the payroll, why did we have to fight them in the first place if we can just buy them off now?
What General McChrystal's talking about is reintegration, and we need to distinguish between reintegration and reconciliation in the lexicon used in Afghanistan, which is different from that was used in Iraq. Reintegration is the idea of breaking off low and mid-level Taliban elements, again, sort of village by village, valley by valley, because there's less coherence to this than, again, you had in Iraq as well. And, of course, it is a much more rugged, mountainous, and rural than the kind of urban and flatter setting that you had in Iraq. That process, we think, is certainly doable. It is something definitely you want to proceed. Again, you can't kill or capture your way out of these kinds of endeavors. That's a necessary component of your strategy. And indeed, there will be an increase in the counterterrorist forces in Afghanistan.
But is that ruled out then at the higher level? Are you saying that there are no talks?
Sure. Now, let me talk about reconciliation.
Right.
Now, reconciliation in the Afghan parlance is the idea of talks at very high levels.
Right.
Indeed, some say as high as Mullah Omar himself, the head of the Afghan Taliban, the Quetta Shura, as it's termed. There have been talks at various times among representatives of President Karzai's government and representatives of the Taliban, facilitated by third parties. Again, very exploratory in third countries and, you know, neutral locations where literally individuals happen to be in the same area at the same time. But the idea that the Taliban, when it is feeling resurgent, would enter serious negotiations, given what it has said are the conditions for it laying down its arms, and given what we know the Afghan government conditions are for reconciling, those are quite divergent right now.
How can you consider the reintegration program with the Taliban low-level operatives a desirable tactic when the CIA lost so many individuals because a double agent someone who they presumably tried to put on the payroll, thinking they were a member of the Taliban or a Taliban sympathizer, marched in with a bomb and committed suicide, taking many of the CIA with him.
Well, the same way, candidly, that we sat down overtime in Iraq with individuals who had our blood on their hands, the same way the Iraqi government has reconciled with certain Shia militia extremist elements, the same way that the United Kingdom reconciled with various IRA figures. It's instructive, in fact, when we were doing this in Iraq, we did have questions. I had commanders come to me and say, sir, are we really going to talk to people that have our blood on their hands? And I'd say I think we are.
General David Petraeus, four-star commander of U.S. Central Command, speaking to me yesterday in Washington, D.C. Part two of that interview is tomorrow. You can go to the website where there's video excerpts, including David Petraeus answering a question from my 8-year-old son, Zachary. Simply, what do generals do? Coming up, our tag segment is all about trains, the technical obstacles and political to getting high-speed rail in the United States. Stay with us. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee, author and historian Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States, died yesterday of a heart attack at age 87.
I was totally taken care of. I didn't have to think about money. Just, there's a million members of the armed forces who have that. But when you ask that the government do this for everybody else, they cry, that's socialism. Well, if that's socialism, it must mean socialism is good.
You know. That's Howard Zinn talking in 2008 about his time in the military. He was never shy about expressing his opinion. A longtime activist and professor emeritus in the political science department at Boston University. 2 weeks ago, he joined veteran journalist Callie Crossley on her show to talk with her. She's with our partner station WGBH in Boston. Callie, good morning.
Good morning.
You asked him when he was on his show what news voices he would add if he was writing his People's History Today, and here was his answer.
I would add the voice of the 12-year-old girl who testified before the Vermont legislature. They were discussing whether to make it legal to have same-sex marriage, and she said, I'm the daughter of two women. They are my parents. And we're a happy family. It was an amazing testimony.
This is a man who was moved by history. He was moved by the subjects on which he was an activist.
You know, it's for someone who had been in the trenches, as they say, for so long, doing just this kind of work, I was actually quite surprised to see him tear up. Tears almost fell down his cheeks. That's how passionate and emotional he was about just sharing with me who he would include at this moment. This was work that just went all the way through him. It stood for what he was, and he was thrilled that a new audience was finding its way to it.
And two audience to A People's History of the United States.
Absolutely. Matt Damon turned that work into a documentary using a lot of well-known actors to portray the voices. And that's what he said to me, was that his biggest excitement was that that kind of star power would bring people to the words and the history. He wanted more than ever for people to understand that the history really was about the people and the people's voices.
Well, he was often asked if he would do an update or a second edition of the People's History. Did he talk to you about what he might include in the book?
Well, the example of that young girl, and he also said he would want to speak to undocumented workers. He thought it's important that we highlight immigrants who are being chastised and persecuted at this point, and say, you know, allow them their voices to say, hey, I have a place here too, and that we hear those voices and have that be a part of what's going on right now in our contemporary history. He thought that would be important.
And did you hear back from listeners after your interview? What was the response of people to Howard Zinn?
Oh, he was well known and well respected here. I have to say that as he was leaving the studio, I said to my production assistant, how old is he again? And she said, 87. I never would have known it. He looked so vibrant in that room.
Well, he has passed away as of yesterday. He suffered a heart attack at the age of 87. Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States. Thanks so much to Callie Crossley of The Callie Crossley Show. It airs on our partner station, WGBH in Boston. And
his last writing was about the Obama administration. Very critical. Called him a potentially mediocre president, which is dangerous.
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Contrary to everyone else in the galaxy, our tech segment is not about the iPad device announced by Apple yesterday. It's about the technical innovations and obstacles to high-speed rail in the United States. Andrea Bernstein is going to join us, along with an official from Amtrak. Right now, here's a check on leading stories. It's coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. This just in, the Labor Department says new requests for unemployment benefits fell to 470,000. Good news, except economists were expecting a bigger drop to 450,000. Last night, the president gave his first State of the Union address, and he had a message for the Democrats.
The Democrats, I would remind you that we still have the largest majority in decades, and the people expect us to solve problems, not run for the hills.
And the president made good on a campaign promise.
This year, I will work with Congress and our military to finally repeal the law that denies gay Americans the right to serve the country they love because of who they are.
The president focused mostly on turning around the economy and creating jobs. In Afghanistan, leaders of one of the largest Pashtun tribes in a Taliban stronghold have agreed to support U.S. operations. Their elders from the tribe pledged to fight the Taliban and to send military-age males and their families to the Afghan army.
In Haiti, the UN World Food Program says they need $800 million to feed 2 million people through the rest of this year. Earlier on The Takeaway, Haitian artist Wyclef Jean said getting shelter for victims is crucial.
You're watching the news right now. You see people are making tents out of plastic, out of paper, and it's going to rain any day now, and we're going to head to a phase two of this disaster.
One relief spokesperson says aid groups divided the capital into zones to better organize food distribution. And now before we talk about trains, let's talk about cars for just a moment. Toyota's massive recall hasn't just affected cars in the U.S. It's also been 75,000 cars recalled in China, and there's also a huge effect in Japan. A lot of people there were surprised by problems with quality at Toyota, and nobody could be more surprised, perhaps, than the Japanese people, and it will have an effect on their society. Earlier, we spoke to the BBC's Japan correspondent, Roland Burke, about the latest from Toyota. I asked him if there was some kind of shock over these recalls in Japan.
There's certainly some alarm about it. Toyota's shares have fallen so far that the company, the parent company, has lost $25 billion in terms of its market capitalization over the last week. I think, though, that perhaps analysts might have feared something like this might have happened. They might have feared that Toyota had taken its eye off the ball in terms of quality over the last decade as it really drove for that massive expansion globally that made it the world's biggest car maker, overtaking General Motors.
How much of a cornerstone of the Japanese economy and society is this company?
Well, it's the biggest, and it's certainly a company that other companies look to. For example, when Toyota decides how much it's going to give its staff as a raise over the year, a lot of other small companies copy that and follow suit. So the fact that it was in a loss was a real sign of how badly Japan's economy had been hit by the global downturn. And this issue over recalls of large numbers of cars, fears about quality, that's going to really knock the confidence of Japan in their economy too.
Thanks. That's Roland Burke, a correspondent from our partner, the BBC, in Japan. And those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So our tech segment today puts us squarely on the rails. Everybody wants to ride a bullet train, okay? And we'd love to not have to go to France or China or Europe to actually, or Japan to actually do it. And last night, we caught a little horse trading on the issue of high-speed rail in President Obama's State of the Union address last night. First, here's the president.
There's no reason Europe or China should have the fastest trains or the new factories that manufacture clean energy products.
And the president went on to say he's going down to Tampa, Florida today to talk high-speed rail with officials in the state of Florida. So Senator Jeff Lemieux went into action. He's the Republican senator from Florida. He went into action to try to figure out how much money was actually coming his way. He called up the transportation secretary.
I talked to Secretary LaHood tonight, right after the president gave his address, and I said, what's the number? How much are we going to get? He said, it's going to be big. And I said, well, what does big mean? Does it mean two And he said, it's very close to two. It's enough to do Tampa to Orlando.
Tampa to Orlando. Does it cost $1 billion or $2 billion? And what are the obstacles to high-speed rail in the United States? That tape from Senator Lemieux, courtesy of our correspondent in Washington, Todd Zwillick. Joining us now, Drew Galloway, Assistant Vice President of Policy and Development for the Eastern Region of Amtrak. Good morning.
Good morning, John. How are you?
And our very own Andrea Bernstein, takeaway correspondent here in the studio. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning.
So we want to divide this up. First, let's talk tech a little bit. There are certainly political and financial obstacles to high-speed rail, and we'll talk about those in a moment. But what are the technical issues of getting an Orlando to Tampa high-speed rail system set up, or one out in California, which was envisioned according to what we're hearing from Washington? Drew Galloway?
Both California and Florida will be built, constructed on new alignments, and that's a key feature for achieving the high speeds that they're going to be able to operate on, whereas most of the other applications that went into this program are building upon existing rail alignments, improving them so that the speeds do increase, but some of the alignments go back to pre-Civil War days.
So we need new rails. Do we need new switching systems, a new power supply?
It's an entirely new system, and I'll have a new electric distribution system. The signal system is all new. The technology is known. It's just a new installation of it. It's new track. It's new alignment. It's new stations.
All right, Andrea Bernstein, takeaway correspondent. We've heard in China that attempts to build high-speed rail between, say, Shanghai and Beijing involves an investment of $300 billion. It appears that in the $1 to $2 billion increments, we're kind of piecemeal doing this. Is that doable? You know all about this stuff.
If you start to think about China, your head will spin.
Yeah.
90% of China is supposed to be served by high-speed rail by the year 2020. So best thing to probably do is focus on what the U.S. will be getting out of this. And, you know, what the advocates for high-speed rail like out of this selection is that it actually helps build two systems, one in Florida. Oh, look at that. Florida. Gee, purple state. Isn't that great? But they had their planning underway, so it was sort of a matter of policy and politics for the White House that they could get their high-speed rail link. And California, which has already voted $9 billion bond act to build a high-speed rail from Northern California to Southern California.
Did these kind of numbers give us the actual trains, though, in both places?
Yes. In Florida, there will actually be bullet trains, and the thing that advocates like is, cool, it's Disneyland, so you get people from all over the country going literally right to Disneyland, and Disney is a partner in this project, and riding the high-speed rails, and people hope going home and creating a political constituency for more high-speed rail. The other big winner in this is the Midwest. Illinois to St. Louis right now takes about 5.5 hours by train. Why? Because the freight trains and the passenger trains are sharing a track.
CSX owns the track, right.
So the idea is, well, we're going to start by creating two tracks there and getting the system maybe, if not high speed, higher speed rail.
Now, there are real estate issues, of course, with doing something like that, acquisition of land, that sort of thing, rights of way, all of that. Drew Galloway, to get all of that implemented, you know, sometimes Amtrak has a really rough time in Congress, particularly with the Republicans. How do you gauge your ability to get this stuff done?
Well, I think we gauge it on the performance. And the Northeast Corridor operates up to speeds of 150 miles an hour today. And it was done through an incremental program that has to be laid out carefully so that you can build the improvements. And there's about $500 million or so we expect in the Northeast that will flow down to the incremental systems. While we continue to operate over 2,000 trains a day.
So
it takes very careful planning. It takes time. You have to do the environmental documentation and make it move forward.
I got my calendar in front of me, and I'll get a response from Andrea in a moment. I want to go from New York City to Orlando with my family on a bullet train. What's the date that I should pencil in?
Push the calendar out a bit.
John, I think that you'll be bringing your grandchildren.
My grandchildren.
Yes,
ooh,
well.
Ouch. Oh, my goodness. Well,
but look, this is what people say. People say, look, it took 30 years to build the interstate highway system.
Good point.
This has to be done incrementally. In the U.S., we're talking about incredibly long distances, longer distances than France or Spain or some of these countries, Japan, where they actually have high-speed rail.
Final.
The sweet spot for corridors is typically in the 200 to 500-mile range.
All right. And so Tampa, Orlando, any other choice places you're looking for, Drew Galloway?
Well, we partnered with states from New York, Connecticut, Maine, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, all of them have put in program applications. All of them will build upon systems or add new alignments, and we're very excited about it in this area.
Well, Drew Galloway is excited, Assistant Vice President of Policy and Development for the Eastern Region of Amtrak, and also Andrea Bernstein joined us, Takeaway Correspondent. Thanks so much.
We've got lots of coverage of the State of the Union speech, not just on our air, but online as well. You can go to thetakeaway.org. You can also podcast our show, re-listen to that interview with General David Petraeus for what he thinks the State of our Union is. You can also join us. We'll have more of John's conversation with the General in tomorrow's show.
And to give us your take on anything in the program at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.